Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle and the Insiders, insight into today's most pressing issues. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, Everyday Heroes, we look at the lesser-known people who have shaped history. Then, a lockdown in Tibet continues with more monks burning themselves to death as acts of protest. We'll hear from a scholar just returning from Tibet and China. And then, on the Scholar Circle, we'll look at the roots of the Tibet-China conflict and how it might be resolved. We know the role of presidents and other leaders in shaping history, but we hear little about the unsung heroes, many who have risked their lives to liberate and rescue others. Who might some of those secret heroes be? We're joined by Paul Martin, journalist, editor, and author of Secret Heroes, Everyday Americans Who Shaped Our World. Welcome, Paul Martin. Often thousands are forgotten for the good they've done in making societies better, and you pulled a few out and wrote about them in your book.
That's right. I've always had a lifelong fascination with unsung heroes, and I've kept a file for years on these characters when I come across them in my reading or see something on television. And when I decided to do a book, I tried to pull out 30 of the most interesting, offering a really broad range of time periods and backgrounds, occupations, and so forth. And the mix that I have is just filled with people that ought to be better known. I mean, there's Hercules Mulligan, who is a tailor in New York City during the Revolutionary War, and he was recruited as a spy. And on two occasions, since he had British officers as customers, he learned about plots to waylay General Washington and was able to warn him and very possibly save his life.
He and his brother. Wasn't his brother also involved?
Was also involved. In fact, his brother was a conduit for another outstanding thing that Mulligan did, and that is he literally converted Alexander Hamilton to the American cause. Hamilton was born in the Caribbean, and he had grown up. He was a loyal British subject. And when he came to study in New York, he went to King's College, which is today's Columbia University, and he needed a place to stay, and he contacted Hercules Mulligan's brother, who referred him on to Hercules, and Alexander Hamilton stayed with Mulligan, and through the course of evening's conversations with Mulligan and his friends, Hamilton was won over to the American cause and became, you know, a real leader.
One of the characters that I thought was most interesting and that I hadn't known as much about as I would have liked to was Mary Elizabeth Bowser, who played a huge role in the Civil War. Tell us about her and her impact on the Civil War.
She was born a slave in Richmond, Virginia, and her master was a hardware merchant in Richmond, and he actually sold off Bowser's family, her mother and father and brother and sister. And when he died, his name was John Van Loo, and when he died, his daughter, Elizabeth Van Loo, bought back Bowser's family and gave them all their freedom. And she, Elizabeth Van Loo, sent Mary Bowser to Philadelphia to be educated. And Bowser came back to Richmond just as the Civil War was starting. And when the Civil War began, Elizabeth Van Loo formed a spy ring for the Union. And she recruited Mary Bowser because she was a rarity. She was a former slave, an African-American who was educated, could read and write, which was obviously a rarity at that time. And Van Loo was able to place her in the White House of the Confederacy, the home of Jefferson Davis and his wife and children. And Bowser was a family servant, and she took care of Jefferson Davis's children and served meals, cleaned up afterwards. Well, as far as Davis knew, she was an illiterate slave, and he and his officers spoke openly in front of her. She also had a photographic memory, and Davis would leave his papers strewn around on his desk, and she could just, at a glance, pick up all sorts of information about Southern troop movements and finances and so forth. She relayed those on to the Union, and she was recognized in 1995 as one of the most important spies for the Union cause during the Civil War.
How was she able to convey that information?
There were some fascinating ways. They would hide messages in like a basket full of eggs. They would hollow out one of the eggs and put messages inside the egg. And another way was they would put it in the shoes of a slave, and the Southerners were disdainful and wouldn't, you know, want to have anything to do with the slaves and their clothing, and so they were able to get things past the the Southern soldiers. So it was an amazing display of bravery for 2 years to be by herself, right, as I said, in the lion's den. And it turned out that she discovered so many secrets that they began to suspect that there was a mole somewhere in the White House of the Confederacy. And so she fled. She was there for 2 years, and her last act was she tried to burn down the White House of the Confederacy. She wasn't successful, but she fled in 1864 and was never heard of again. She disappeared from history.
There were three other women that I thought were particularly interesting in your book. Anne Royal was one, Grace Abbott, and Inez Boisevain.
Yes, all three of those I'd never heard of, and in fact, I could say I think all but one or two of the characters in my book I'd never heard of, and I wasn't familiar with even the ones that I had heard of. For instance, Hedy Lamarr, I didn't know the achievements she did that were totally unknown to the public. But the three persons that you mentioned, Anne Royal was just this fabulous character. She was born on the frontier and survived Indian attacks, and she ended up marrying an older man who was quite wealthy. And when he died, she traveled around a bit, and she was well-to-do. But then her husband's family overturned the will, and she was left absolutely penniless at the age of 54. And so she decided she'd become a writer, and she started writing travel books, and she wrote one novel. And she lived hand-to-mouth the whole time. And then she went to Washington, D.C., and when she was in her 60s, she began a newspaper, and she was a terror. She was the first muckraker in American journalism, and she would traipse around the halls of Congress and government offices and just buttonhole officials and grill them. She would print everything, you know, she found, and she had very strong opinions. She was adamantly for the separation of church and state, and she was just a holy terror.
I think you mentioned that people still study her in journalism schools.
They do. She's regarded as the first of the muckrakers. She's really the first investigative journalist in early journalism, history of journalism. Journalism often was advertising or PR almost, and she really dug for the truth and was fearless. And she made so many enemies that the U.S. Post Office stopped delivering her newspaper because she made so many enemies on Capitol Hill. So she started a second newspaper and delivered it on her own. And, of course, she never had a very wide circulation or never made any money. In fact, she died. I think she had a total of 6 cents when she died. But her influence was tremendous.
And then the other two really interesting women, Grace Abbott and Inez Boisevain, had to have a little bit more of a similar impact.
Grace Abbott is just someone that you never hear of, and the woman was absolutely amazing. She grew up in Nebraska and was trained as a teacher, and she went to Chicago and studied at the University of Chicago, and then she became involved in protecting immigrants. And for 9 years, she ran the Immigrant Protective League. And then she was recruited to the U.S. Children's Bureau, which at that time was a federal office to overlook the rights of the interests of children. And she improved the lives of millions of people through information she distributed on maternal health care and infant health care. Even then and still today, the infant mortality rate in this country is really shocking. We have 4 times the infant mortality rate of Japan today. And she did so much to protect the children. The other thing she did was she was instrumental in writing the child labor provisions of the Social Security Act. And she also wrote child labor provisions in the Fair Labor Standards Act, which was passed in 1938. Unbelievably, there was still exploitative child labor up to 1938, but afterwards, when that law was passed, we finally ended that shameful period of our history. The other person you mentioned, Inez Boisevain, she was a colorful character. She was one of the few characters in the book who grew up in a wealthy family. And she had a privileged upbringing. She went to Vassar College, but she was a real rebel, and she was in the forefront of the women's suffrage movement, and she made speeches on campus, and as I said in the book, I think the people at Vassar probably threw themselves a party when she finally graduated. But she went on to New York, and she got a law degree at New York University, and one of the first things she did was investigate the horrible conditions, prison conditions at Sing Sing, and she wrote a report, and it resulted in widespread reforms. And she literally gave her life for the cause. She was speaking in the western half of the United States trying to get a passage of universal women's suffrage, and she had she collapsed on stage in Los Angeles, and it turned out she had pernicious anemia, which today is very treatable, but back then it wasn't, and she ended up dying, and so she was a martyr to her cause, and
only 30 years old.
Exactly. They told her if she cut back and stopped exerting herself, she could probably weather this this health issue. But she refused to. She literally gave her life for the cause.
And then, if we were to move up in time, there are two other people. They're very different. One was Golden Rule Jones, who was very interesting, and the other was Kirk Bloodsworth.
Golden Rule Jones, of course, was a progressive leader during the progressive era at the turn of the 20th century. He started out, grew up poor, and he got into the oil business, and he started his own company and made a fortune. He moved to Ohio and started Ohio Oil, which was bought out by Standard Oil, and so he became quite wealthy. But he had a tragedy in his life. His wife and one of his children passed away, and he remarried, and his second wife lived in Toledo. So he moved to Toledo, and he started a company to produce oil drilling equipment. It had the memorable name of the Acme Sucker Rod Company. And he was 50 years ahead of his time. He instituted an 8-hour workday. He refused to use child labor. I mean, this was all before, while these things were going on, he was doing these things on his own. He gave Christmas bonuses, paid vacations. He built a park and playground for his employees. And his whole point of view was that everyone should live by the golden rule. I mean, it was very simple, and that's the way he treated his employees, and they responded with incredible loyalty. Well, he became famous for this, and they started around Toledo, started calling him Golden Rule Jones. And then he was put up for election by the Republicans and for mayor of Toledo, and he won. And the amazing thing was that when he started introducing the same kinds of reforms that he'd done in his company to city government, the Republicans were up in arms. The business interests, they thought, this was not the way to go. So they, the next election for mayor, they kicked him to the side, and he ran as an independent, and he won with 70% of the vote, and he was reelected three other times. He finally he died in office when he was 54, but he was a real progressive, and he was one of the people who brought us things that we accept today as just, everyone thinks that a 40-hour work week and paid vacations are, the right of all Americans. But if it wasn't for people like Samuel Jones, that just wouldn't have happened. The other person you mentioned, Kirk Bloodsworth, he's interesting for several reasons. One, he's the only living character of the 30 people I write about. He's still alive. He grew up on the eastern shore of Maryland. He was his family was they were watermen. He grew up, crabbing and oystering, helping his dad on his boat. And he joined the Marines. And after the Marines, he married a woman who lived in Essex, Maryland, which is a suburb of Baltimore. And at the very time that he settled in Essex, a 9-year-old girl was brutally raped and murdered. And Kirk Bloodsworth was arrested for this. He had nothing to do with it. He was completely innocent. And he was convicted basically on the testimony of a 7-year-old and a 10-year-old child, children, who said they saw him. Well, he spent 9 years in prison. He was convicted and given the death sentence, and he was sent to prison in Baltimore, the state prison penitentiary. His death sentence was overturned. He was given 2 life terms. And to while away the time, I mean, to keep himself sane, he would read a lot in the prison library, and he happened to read a book about DNA profiling, which was perfected in 1984 by a professor in Leicester, England, and a light bulb went on, and buzzwords said, "Well, this could be used to prove I was not the killer." And it just happened that his attorney had asked that all the evidence in the case be saved, and it was sent to a lab in California and tested, and he was exonerated and set free after 9 years in prison. He was the first death row inmate to be set free by DNA testing in this country.
And then he went on and made it part of his cause.
He did. He was instrumental in getting the Innocence Protection Act and the testing portion of that act, which any convicted prisoner is tested for DNA now. Their DNA is recorded, and that test is named in Bloodsworth's honor.
Well, Paul Martin, thank you so much, and thank you for honoring the everyday Americans who shape our world. The book, again, is called Secret Heroes. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Maria.
You are listening to The Scholar Circle and The Insiders, insight into today's most pressing issues. I'm Maria Armudian. An acrimonious conflict continues between China and Tibet. Hundreds of Tibetans remain in detention, and some 38 people have self-immolated in protest. With us now is University of Southern California Professor of International Relations, Laurie Brand. She has just returned from China and Tibet and has joined us to share her experiences and impressions from her trip.
I was there on a tour that was in part participated in by Trojan Alumni Travel. So I went along as a faculty lecturer. I gave one lecture dealing with diaspora and migration, another lecture dealing with Chinese-Middle East relations. But it just so happened that part of this trip involved 4 days in Tibet. I didn't go as an expert on China or Tibet. I went as an academic and somebody who could talk about some broader issues that might be of interest to people who are on the trip.
I'm wondering if any of those broader issues would have touched on the uprisings that occurred in the Middle East, because I understand that's been sort of blocked out as much as possible in China.
Well, that was part of what I wanted to talk about, and I thought that might be of interest to people. And since I'm not a China expert, but I do, you know, work, obviously the Middle East is my area, I thought people might be interested in that. So I did talk a bit about China's relations, particularly with Syria and with Iran, but not in great detail. The people in the group sort of led the discussion in a somewhat different direction after I gave the initial lecture, and they were really very interested in questions of migration and citizenship and so on. So that's what most of our discussion focused on.
Did anybody ask about the organization of the Arab uprisings?
No, not really. I was introduced to them as the lecturer rather late. A lot of them hadn't read the informational materials, and so, you know, unless I actually sat with somebody at dinner and explained who I was, they just thought I was a regular tour member. So my expertise didn't come out until sort of slowly, or it came out only slowly and as the trip unfolded. And there were several people who were interested in Islam. And in fact, my husband, who's Muslim, had a number of conversations with people about Islam. But there wasn't a great deal of interest, interestingly enough, specifically in the Middle East.
They haven't heard very much about it, I think. You mentioned that while you were there, the military came and closed off entry again. What happened?
What happened actually was that the day that we left China, not the day that we left Tibet, because we were in Beijing and then Xi'an, and then we went to Lhasa, which is in Tibet, Then after the time in Lhasa, we went to Chongqing and ended up in Shanghai. So we had almost a full week in China after leaving Tibet. The Sunday that we left from Shanghai, there were, I believe, two additional self-immolations in Lhasa on the main square, which is in front of a temple, which is, Lhasa itself is the heart of Tibetan Buddhism. And this has been the place where at least some of the self-immolations have taken place. So I found out about that after I got back to the U.S., but then I found out several days later that the Chinese authorities had closed off access to foreign tourists to Tibet. And this is not the first time this has happened. It's happened a number of times in the past when there have been disturbances and the Chinese authorities are particularly concerned about, you know, keeping these things under wraps, not having them be, you know, publicized or not getting a lot of attention. But apparently this is one of the first times that this has happened during high tourism season. And so Tibet stands to take a serious economic hit as a result of the closure of the area to tourists. And I don't know, have no idea how long they're likely to keep this in place. But they clearly were concerned about perhaps further immolations, potential escalation, and they just don't want foreigners there. You can't go into Tibet as a foreigner without, you have to get special permission and have to go in with some sort of authorized agency, some sort of a touring company or a tour guide is responsible for you. So they don't want foreigners just going in and kind of wandering around exploring.
And learning about what the issues are, perhaps.
Certainly not learning about them unattended to, unguided. I don't speak Mandarin and I don't speak Tibetan, so a lot of what one could learn is inaccessible to me without a translator. And we were asked by the person from the tour company before we went into Tibet to please be respectful of our Tibetan guide and to not ask sensitive questions that would put her on the spot. So people in general, I think, were very mindful of that, so they didn't try and push on difficult questions. But to the degree that one observes and tries to piece things together, even when you don't have the local language, I mean, the area was highly militarized. You know, I'm used to seeing soldiers on corners because I spent a lot of time in the Middle East in the, you know, 70s and 80s and so on. But there was a significant, what I would call, security presence. I don't know enough about the various distinctions in China between, you know, police and various military forces. But clearly in Lhasa, there were security people all over the place. You had, as I said, we had a special permission to go in, and then there was a checkpoint as we were entering Lhasa. We encountered a couple of other checkpoints during our movement around Tibet, which didn't extend much beyond Lhasa. We had one sort of overnight visit in the Tsedang Valley, which is outside of Lhasa, and that was beautiful and very interesting. But the Tibetan guide who was with us asked us, please, not to take any photos of any military people. And particularly in the heart of Lhasa, which again, as I said, is sort of the heart of Tibetan Buddhism, and specifically in the square, which is in front of the Jokhang Palace, where past self-immolations have taken place, there were a number of military people. And then as we were getting ready to leave, the day that we happened to be there, there were a large number of, again, police, military, I don't know exactly what their units were, assembled. It seemed to be for the arrival of some sort of a dignitary. But what I found most striking was that among the security people assembled, there were several guys there who were clearly wearing inflammable suits. So they were there to take care of fires. And of course, you know, one knows what that means. And in fact, also at the very base of this large square, at the furthest extent of the square, there was a fire engine that was there the entire time. So they clearly meant to be prepared and to show that kind of preparedness for the possibility of that kind of an anti-government demonstration.
Now, given your expertise, which is really in the Middle East, had you seen things that were really comparable? Was this like what you had seen in some of the highly militarized states that you studied?
Well, when I first started going to the region in the late 70s, a lot of time in Egypt, and then I got very used to seeing soldiers on street corners with, you know, machine guns. And I find it interesting now when I hear Americans who travel and they find that really off-putting. I mean, I don't find it endearing, but it's something that I came to sort of accept and almost became inured to. I mean, the only concern was, does the guy in the corner actually know how to operate this thing and is it loaded? Because they don't all necessarily all inspire confidence. It wasn't as though there were military in every corner, but there were a lot of people walking around. And so I don't know how much of this was a result of the fact that this high level, I assume he was a member of the party, was coming for a visit. I don't know how much of it was attributable to that. I don't know how much of it was attributable to the fact that we happened to be there on a day that was particularly holy in the Buddhist lunar calendar. There are, I think, 5 days each month, depending on the number of the day, that are particularly holy and therefore are days that tend to attract more pilgrims to these areas. And so there were a lot of people there as part of pilgrimage, so the security presence may have been heightened because of that. I just don't know. I do know, I remember very clearly in the spring, that there were disturbances in Tibet. I believe they were in eastern Tibet at that time, so Lhasa tends to be sort of central-ish Tibet. And I wondered at the time whether they might not cancel our tour or cancel that part of the tour. I was really worried that, you know, we were going to find out from the company that you're not going to be allowed to go into Tibet. That didn't happen, obviously. But it's certainly clear that the government is very concerned about any kind of disturbances. And so to compare it to previous experiences in the Middle East, I don't know that I've seen that much military around in that small an area in a sort of in a long, long time, unless they were sort of cordoning off an area for, you know, a presidential procession or a parade to come through or something like that. I haven't spent much time at all in the occupied West Bank, but it brought to mind some of the images of, you know, occupation soldiers in the West Bank. That's what I thought of.
Could you get a sense either of the landscape economically there or really ethnically?
Well, I know from a little bit of background reading that I tried to do before going that there has been a program on the part of the Chinese government to introduce, to encourage non-Tibetans, so Chinese from other parts of the country, to settle there, to try and change the, you know, the ethnic balance so that it's not as overwhelmingly Tibetan as otherwise. Stores and various, you know, all businesses and offices are required to have signs in Mandarin. I think, you know, Tibetan is optional. Most stores have both. You see that, but oftentimes the Mandarin characters are above the name of the store or the name of the office. It's written in Tibetan. Every other city that we saw in China, there's tremendous construction going on, perhaps a little bit less in Lhasa than we saw in some of the mega cities that we visited. But clearly there are lots of new apartment buildings going up, and my guess is that these are for migrants from other parts of China that are being attracted there. Now, having said that, it's unlike the coastal zones, which are the areas in which the growing industries of the last, you know, 20 years, 30 years have been and continue to be concentrated. The western zones of the country in general have not enjoyed the same kind of economic growth. So there is a concern about that. And I think one of the reasons in particular that there's a concern about the fact that Tibet is now closed off to tourists is that because this is tourism season, that this would be an important part of the income to the local economy, which they're going to lose out on. And I did have a brief exchange with a young woman in one of the shops in a hotel we stayed in, and she said to me something about Tibet, no money. So clearly there's a sense that they're struggling. Having said that, what we saw, what we were allowed to see, was not indicative of terrible poverty. But again, you're only taken to certain places, so it's very difficult based on just a short trip and one that's heavily guided to make any kind of, you know, real comment on that.
Well, thank you for that. When we come back, the roots of the China-Tibet conflict and how to resolve it. Stay tuned. Good. Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. Late last month, two more Tibetan monks set themselves on fire, ostensibly as a protest against Chinese repression. In early June, another Tibetan died in detention, allegedly due to medical negligence. There are allegations of beatings and torture in efforts to extract confessions. Tensions are high between China and Tibet. What are the roots of the conflict between China and Tibet, and how can the conflict be resolved? We're joined by three experts. Robbie Barnett is director of Modern Tibet Studies Program and professor of Tibetan Studies at Columbia University. His books include A Poisoned Arrow, The Secret Petition of the 10th Panchen Lama. Perry Link also joins us. He is professor of Chinese Literature and Languages and the Chancellorial Chair for Innovative Teaching at the University of California at Riverside. His books include Evening Chats in Beijing, and he co-translated the Tiananmen Papers, an inside account of key leadership deliberations over the Tiananmen democracy protests. Also with us is Emily Yap, professor of geography at the University of Colorado. She has authored many book chapters, including Living Together in Lhasa, Ethnic Relations, Coercive Amity, and Subaltern Cosmopolitanism. Welcome to the three of you. Thank you so much for being with us. Robbie Barnett, I thought perhaps you could start us with the historical context necessary to understand this situation. Can you walk us through the dynastic period, the British invasion, Mao, the 17-point agreement, and how they relate to what's going on today?
Well, it's quite a complex picture. And of course, different sides have different views of the history, but the history is the crucial issue here that's being fought over. Essentially, Tibet was independent many hundreds of years ago. Gradually, in about the 17th century, it begins to fall under the influence of the Manchu dynasty in China. And by the 18th, 19th century, that's quite a strong relationship. But it never becomes part of China. It becomes part of an empire that is being ruled by Manchu leaders in China. And by the 19th century, that rule, the rule from Beijing, is fairly weak. And the Tibetans are able to establish themselves more and more as a de facto independent state. But they never get that legally clarified in the international community. The Manchus collapse, 1912, 1913, and the Tibetans try to establish their independence with the help of the British. The British play a very tricky game and only give partial acknowledgement to the Tibetans, and that isn't enough to protect Tibet. 50 years later, 1950, the Chinese unified again under Mao Zedong and the Communist Party under Mao Zedong, and he ascends his army into Tibet, and it forces the Tibetans into a kind of surrender, which is called the 17-point agreement. It signs a treaty when, for the first time ever, we find the document where the Tibetans say they are part of China. And in return, the Chinese promise them a kind of autonomy. It doesn't last very long. In 1959, there's major unrest in Tibet. A kind of rebel army has formed to fight the Chinese, and it's overthrown by the PLA. The Dalai Lama flees to India with about 80,000 Tibetans, and they are still in India. For about 30 years, they ran a kind of semi-military campaign to try to fight the Chinese secretly with the support of the CIA. But since 1980s, late 70s, the Dalai Lama has been trying to go back to China, trying to persuade the Chinese to let him come back in return for giving real autonomy to the Tibetans. And the Chinese refuse so far to accept this, because they say that he secretly harbors the plan to reestablish independence. So that's the situation we're in now, profound distrust and disbelief on either side.
Before we move into the present, I thought it might be interesting to look at this from the Chinese and the Tibetan perspective. One of the things you wrote about, Robbie Barnett, is the series of so-called gifts from China. What were these, and what is their role in setting up the current situation?
Well, I think this is the key element to help us try to understand the alternative view to this issue, the Chinese view, not just the view that we're familiar with in the West. From a Chinese point of view, specifically a Chinese communist, a modern Chinese point of view, Tibet is a place where China has helped. And it certainly has helped in terms of economics, infrastructure, roads, development, modernity, and so on. But actually, if we look at China's relationship with Tibet, since Mao sent his army in the 1950s, it's always been the idea of the gift from the Chinese point of view. They were originally trying to give Tibetans the gift of a freedom from imperialists. They argued that the British and the Americans were interfering in Tibet, and China had come there to free Tibetans from that interference. By 1959, 57 even, they changed their tune and said they were freeing Tibetans from the scourge of feudalism and brutal class oppression by the aristocrats and monasteries. And later, in the Cultural Revolution, they see it as a gift at the time, that they're freeing them from old traditions, old culture, and the class system. Now we have another kind of gift that Chinese people really believe in, and of course they can see it, the gift of modernity, and so on. I think it's very difficult for many Chinese people who are brought up with this idea that they've been generous, they've been helping these Tibetans are rather backward. It's very hard for them when they're criticized by outsiders for what they see as generosity.
Perry Link, bring us from this point to the modern situation. You've written that you think the roots of the crisis are really the same as the roots of the crisis in all of China. How do you see this?
Primarily, I defer on all questions of Tibet to my friend Robbie Barnett. As a very broad generalization, I feel there's another factor in the Chinese push towards Tibet, and that's this grand ancient civilization felt humiliated in the last two centuries because of the arrival of the West with its superior technology, and in a struggle to get back its pride, is pushing outward in several directions, not just towards Tibet, but toward Mongolia and the South Seas we see in recent times. And that's why Taiwan is such a sore point as well. And I think that this nationalism that underlies Chinese pride is one of the big engines that not only pushes toward Tibet, but makes this the feeling so sensitive. Another factor is that the authoritarian government in China uses this nationalism in order to distract the attention of its own citizens from domestic problems like corruption and pollution and the huge wealth gap. There's a lot of domestic problems in China today that aren't well enough known in the West. And the leaders in Beijing need to try to stay on top of this very difficult situation. One tool that they have is to stimulate nationalism. And one way to stimulate nationalism is to find a way to blame the Dalai Lama for splitting the motherland, because this strikes a deep chord in Chinese popular thinking, nationalist chord. That's my capsule view of what is at stake here from the Chinese side.
Emily Yeh, let's bring you in, because this brings up the whole issue of identity and culture, which you have studied.
I'd like to add a little bit just to Robbie's comment about the gift. I think this idea, and it's really kind of connected to nationalism too, where the state has been really successful at convincing the broad population of Chinese people that, you know, the Tibetans are ungrateful. And one example of this is that there's been this new campaign. It's called Gratitude Education, and it goes along with various kinds of development projects in Tibetan areas where the state is spending money to build houses, to build all sorts of infrastructure. But along with that, it's very much accompanied with the idea that Tibetans must learn to be properly grateful. And I think the other issue in terms of identity and culture is that, especially since 2008, the dynamic has been one in which any sort of expression of Tibetan cultural identity as distinct, unique, increasingly becomes read as a political statement, right? So there's sort of an ever-tightening amount of space for any kind of Tibetan cultural expression. I think it's that conflation of anything cultural with a political stance that has really kind of led us to this present conjuncture.
One of the things, Emily Yeh, that you also looked at was the 2008 uprisings in particular. How do you see the 2008 rising? To whom were they directed, and what really happened during them and after?
The main perspective that I'm critical of is the idea that the protests were manipulated from the outside. And that's something that very much many people across China have come to believe. Certainly it's the discourse that the state has promoted, but also some intellectuals in the West, what I was writing about there. And so it's this idea that Tibetans inside are manipulated by Western imperialism or that they're very, very directed by people in India. And my point partly is that people in Tibet have a set of very legitimate grievances and they don't need manipulation from the outside. You know, they can think for themselves and decide upon specific actions. The other critique, and I'm certainly Robbie and others have written a lot about this, is the portrayal of the Lhasa event in 2008 as sort of typical or representative. And in terms of actual violence against people, it was a very, very minor part of this very widespread movement that happened in 2008.
Robbie Barnett, let's bring you back in on this, on a couple things. One would be this identity question. It's something that you've also tackled, and you've talked about who the Tibetans are, and perhaps they're not really as homogenous as people like to think of them, and what this identity really means to the whole political situation. How do we parse out the politics and the identity?
It is a very difficult question, and this is why institutions like the universities in the Western system are so valuable, is that when we want to think about this kind of question, the identity question, the driving forces behind political conflicts, it's really important to look at culture and history, not just to look at the raw issues of politics and where the armies are and what governments are doing. And when we look at Tibetan contemporary culture, rather than just the political statements, the few that come out of Tibet, we're able to see a really complex picture that is actually intellectually and artistically very satisfying, very exciting to watch people who are now writing novels, short stories, poems, songs, paintings, and so on. To look at these, we start to then get beyond this tendency that we have, especially in the West, when we talk about an Asian or foreign country outside the Euro-American sphere, we tend to think of it as one big group with one big idea, one big grievance, or one big problem. And when we look at the cultural production that's still existing in Tibet, we see that complexity. We see different kind of ideas, different debates going on among Tibetans to the extent that they're allowed to debate anything. And we see richness of texture, thought, and the way they use their past as well as using their present. So there we begin to see the identity is quite varied. We see people who are very committed to the religious tradition, who see that Buddhism in Tibet as the way they can pull themselves together as a united kind of single people. We see other people who think that that's wrong. They want a kind of secular identity. We see other people who try to find identity through doing business or commerce, people who find identity through looking at traditions, maybe not religious traditions in Tibet. So there's a lot of variety there. What we don't see is a history of a single people that all think the same, that are all totally committed to one idea of who they are. We see big regional differences, and we see big differences historically between those regions. But increasingly, as they move into the modern sphere, to the extent they're able to talk in public, which isn't that much, we do see a growing sense of a kind of modern national identity. Tibetans who are very different, given histories, thinking of themselves all as Tibetans with a similar kind of collective modern project. That's certainly happening, and it's partly a response to modernity, but it's mainly a response to Chinese pressure, these constant attacks they're getting from the Chinese state. So the identity is being welded together by China to some extent.
Perry Link, can you address this issue and perhaps bring the Dalai Lama into this picture?
I would like to tie together something that Emily said and something that Robbie said. Emily spoke of the problem in China of education about Tibet and the Chinese media's portrayal of Tibet. Those are really very crucial issues. Young people in China just don't get a square look at Tibet, because in the schools they're given a very thin version of what serfdom, feudal serfdom as it's called, was in the past, and what the Dalai Lama, wolf in sheep's clothing, is doing in order to split the motherland today. That's what young people learn. And then when the 2008 events happened, the Chinese media immediately called them riots, and showed all over the country, almost continuously, for the next 72 hours, very thin version of what had happened, where young Tibetan males were the ones causing all of the trouble. If we stand back and look at this from the point of view of the Chinese audience, it's hard to blame them for getting narrow and distorted and thin perceptions of what Tibetan culture is. And here's where my comment relates to much of what Robbie just said about the complexity of Asian cultures and the autonomy of Tibetan culture, which is not the same as Chinese culture, not the same as a lot of other kinds of things, and even within Tibetan culture, there are rich and varied traditions. If ordinary Chinese people were exposed to that, there would be much less trouble. If they could get a square look at what Tibetans really are, what they're like, what their history is, the animosity would go way down. The problem is that they don't get that square look. They get this very thin, tendentious look that the men who rule in Beijing are bent on giving to them.
Which sounds like the opposite of what the West are getting in terms of the picture of what's going on in China and Tibet. So it speaks to issues related to communication and mass media and control.
That's certainly true, although I would point out that the Western views of Tibet, naive and rosified as they often are already considerably more complex than the official version of Tibet in the Chinese media.
Just a reminder that you are listening to The Scholar Circle, and we are talking about the conflict between China and Tibet. There's also a geographical dimension, which is also Emily Ye's area. Emily, you've looked at this so-called Tibetan Range Wars.
Yeah, that refers to actually conflict among Tibetans over access to grasslands. And it was actually more of an issue in the late 1990s and early 2000s than it is now. I wouldn't say it's directly related to the conflict. It does tell us a lot about state authority and how governance works in that area, insofar as many of the conflicts can be traced in large part to the ways in which administrative boundaries were set, often crossing lines of traditional authority, and also just to sort of more and more privatized forms of grassland management. And interestingly, the state officials were often completely unable to really settle the conflicts and had to sort of invite religious officials in order for groups of Tibetans to actually stop fighting against each other, which is ironic on a lot of levels. So the state was really kind of dependent on religious authorities while at the same time trying to kind of ultimately deprive them of authority in favor of the secular.
Is there also a geographic dimension that deals with moving people around, like moving Han people into Tibet and moving Tibetans into other regions?
There's two different things. I mean, in terms of the question of moving Han people in, a lot of the Han who move into Tibetan areas today are people who are not being moved by deliberate state programs. So it's not a program like, you know, we see in Indonesia, for example, this transmigration program. But certainly the state, the particular ways in which it sets subsidies and gives projects, creates a whole set of incentives that, you know, make it profitable for migrants from other parts of China to move to Tibet. But there's also a military presence, which is very different. There are Chinese cadres who move in for a certain number of years at a time, and they are state-directed. But the large percentage of Chinese migrants really are driven by incentives, but not direct programs. In terms of resettlement, there is now a very large set of resettlement programs in eastern Tibet, in particular in the area that is called the Source of the Three Rivers, so the Yellow Yangtze and Mekong River headwaters area in Qinghai. And there's a very large-scale attempt to basically move pastoralists to towns and cities in the name of environmental protection. And so that certainly is very disruptive for people's livelihoods and culture. And that is mostly happening in the East.
How do we see a potential resolution coming from this issue? Is it resolvable? Is the juxtaposition of authoritarianism versus autonomy, are these things just completely in conflict, or can they move towards resolution? Robbie Barnett?
My view on this question is really an optimistic one, and I think people often look at it in an unnecessarily but understandably negative way. This is not Palestine. It's not even Kosovo. It's not an issue that is is already so embedded in conflict that it can't be easily resolved. It's very easy to resolve on paper. The Dalai Lama has said he will give up the idea of independence. He'll accept autonomy if it has certain kinds of guarantees in it, which are basically about culture and economy, education, and so on. And the Chinese won't give those at the moment, but they're very easy to give on paper. So we have really the makings of a possible solution, and that's because we have a Dalai Lama who's increasingly become the spokesman for the vast, vast majority of Tibetans, as far as we can tell. So the Chinese have an opportunity to negotiate with him, make some offers about protecting culture and language and solving the problem. It really is that simple. The problem is they won't do that because they don't trust him, and maybe for some other reasons as well. But they could do it. And they have problems. They have a tradition. They're locked into their own traditions, which Perry has talked about, of believing they mustn't show any weakness. They mustn't show that they're under pressure from the West. They mustn't show that they are soft, or that they give in to anything, and so on. So the Chinese leadership is also locked down here. But the real problem is that the Dalai Lama is getting older. He's in his mid-70s now. He's trying to hand over power to a successor exile administration that doesn't have his charisma, doesn't have his authority, that would probably find it very difficult to get the Chinese to resolve anything with them. So the prospects of a negotiated settlement, it's really possible on paper. It's receding very, very fast. If somebody doesn't step in soon to persuade the Chinese to consider this, it's going to be too late, and then we're going to be facing a very, very difficult future for a very long time, which will be probably dominated by conflict.
Perry Link.
I would like to add a footnote to what Emily said about the immigration. I'm sure she agrees with this. And that's that it's not the movement of Han people into traditionally Tibetan areas that rankles Tibetans, but the class difference between them, because the Han people live at a higher level socioeconomically, and this is resented. On the question of the solution, I think that Robbie is right on with his description of the ameliorative role that the Dalai Lama could play if he were allowed to. I guess I'm slightly pessimistic that the question can be answered until the authoritarian structure in China ends. And frankly, I think it's more fragile than people on the outside have been estimating. In the last 6 months, we've seen signs of tension and nervousness about trying to keep the lid on, trying to keep the system in place. And of course, I don't have a crystal ball, and I won't predict that a major change will happen in 1 year or 10 or 15, but I do think that that is the best hope for a solution to the so-called Tibet problem, because the core of the problem is in the policies of the nervous authoritarians who are in Beijing.
Emily, yeah?
I definitely agree with Harry Link. It's about the fact that the economy, the political economy, is structured so that the migrants are at an advantage over most local Tibetans in terms of employment and opportunity, and that is a major part of the problem. In terms of a step forward, I basically agree with what Robbie said. Linking that back to an earlier point, I think there was a moment, you know, before 2008, certainly in the 2000s, when things looked much more hopeful, not so much just in terms of the state, but in terms of many Chinese sort of becoming much more interested in Tibetan culture and being much more open to various ways of thinking about Tibet, Tibetan history, Tibetan identity, and really wanting to learn from Tibetans. And we saw that, for example, with a lot of environmental cooperation between Tibetans and Chinese. And that has really been kind of closed down with the way in which the state has chosen to govern Tibetan areas since 2008. But I think that that undercurrent is still there, and in conjunction with, I think, some sort of change in the governance structure, the fact that, you know, many Chinese are imagining and thinking about Tibet differently is a hopeful sign. I was in China briefly earlier this year, and with all the news about the self-immolations, you know, I was very depressed, but I found people that I spoke with, they still seem to think, you know, that there was time and hope that things can actually change pretty quickly.
Professor Barnett, Emily did bring up the issue of the self-immolation and some of the responses to that. Why immolation?
Well, we don't really know. We know that of the 38 or so Tibetans inside Tibet who have immolated themselves. About 25 of those have died in doing it. About four have left statements, which they sent out, or audio tapes, which they sent out to exiles before they died. They show, really, there's kind of different kind of politics for those people. They're mainly monks, or former monks, and some nuns. And their politics isn't about what kind of political structure they want in the future. They don't talk about whether Tibet should be independent or whether it should be autonomous. They talk about the idea of freedom, that's very important, and they talk about the nation, the Tibetan nation that they're dying for. But they particularly give their details about this in terms of culture. They say, you must protect the Tibetan language. You must, after I die, educate Tibetan children so they know who we are and so they know about our traditions, our practices. This is a very important indication of something that's happening here. It's a different kind of politics from the politics you often hear among Tibetan exiles in the West, who are really talking about, you know, a kind of political future where they want to have total independence for some of them or something like this. This is really people talking about the increasing pressures they're finding in their lives to maintain identity and practices that they associate with their community. But I think we have to remember another thing. We're looking at what Perry described, so, and Emily, about 2008, protests which were very large, about 150 across the Tibetan plateau, that were presented by China in the media as violent, because about three or four of them did involve violence, and at least 18 Chinese were killed. And now we're finding that was turned to the advantage of the state and demonized Tibetans in a very unfortunate way. Now we're finding Tibetans discovering that immolation is a protest which has huge impact across Tibet and across the world, and yet it doesn't involve violence against another person. And it also has huge resonance in early Buddhist tradition as a religious act, an act of devotion. So maybe what we're seeing in immolations is Tibetans learning from what went wrong with these big street protests in 2008 and trying to find a specifically Tibetan or Buddhist way of drawing attention to their concerns in a way that the state can't turn against them and say is a form of violence against others. That seems to be what's happening.
Great. Thank you so very much for this wonderful and informative discussion. We really appreciate your time and your wisdom. Robbie Barnett is director of Modern Tibet Studies Program and professor of Tibetan Studies at Columbia University. His books include A Poisoned Arrow, The Secret Petition of the 10th Panchen Lama. Perry Link is professor of Chinese Literature and Languages and the Chancellorial Chair for Innovative Teaching at the University of California at Riverside. His books include Evening Chats in Beijing, and he co-translated the Tiananmen Papers, an inside account of key leadership deliberations over the Tiananmen democracy protests. Emily Yap is professor of Geography at the University of Colorado. She has authored many book chapters, including Living Together in Lhasa, Ethnic Relations, Coercive Amity, and Subaltern Cosmopolitanism. That's it for today's show. I'd like to thank all of our guests and our producers, Ankine Aghasyan and Melissa Shiprin, and our assistant producers, Ishmael Karim and Carlson Dezuras. If you missed a part of this show, you can always go back to the kpfk.org archives and listen. You can always podcast us, and you can keep up with us at scholarcircle.org or armudian.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at @armudian. We'll see you next week.